Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown. Operation Catapult. Winston Churchill and the British attack on the French Navy. In July 1940, just weeks after France signed an armistice with Germany, Winston Churchill made one of World War II's most shocking decisions. And I find the most shocking thing is, and not a lot of people, as Michael Caine would say, not a lot of people know what happened next. One man who does is friend of the show, I think we can call him now, Bill Whiteside, who's in a new book called Operation Catapult. I'd like to say that Bill joins me at some ungodly hour in the morning from somewhere on the East Coast, West Coast, or somewhere across the pond. Bill, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Giles. Great to see you. Thank you for having me on your show.
The pleasure is all mine. So, again, if people are drawing a sort of timeline, if you like, with the Second World War, this shocking attack or shocking decision, it completely sort of, so many people don't know about this. So set the scene if you can, Bill.
Sure, I'll do my best. Thank you. And I think that's one of the most compelling things about the story is that it's so shocking because it's so surprising. It's a lot about Winston Churchill. And the fact that he would have his Navy turn on his very recent ally, France, and not just an ally on paper, but a country that he absolutely adored, just seems so terribly out of character. And that was the first thing that attracted me. When I first read it in a Churchill biography, I thought, I misread that. That could not have happened. And then I started digging into the story and learning that the facts of the story were, in 1940, obviously, that was when the Second World War really took off. May 10th, 1940 was when Germany invaded the Low Countries and then France the next day. And at that point, France and Britain had been allies for 9 months. They declared war 9 months before that, but there was not a lot of action except on sea. There were some very ferocious sea battles. And the fighting went very poorly for France very quickly. And, you know, the British more or less left France from the shores of Dunkirk, and France was left to fight pretty much on the ground on their own. Several months before that, Britain and France had signed a very logical document saying that neither country would seek a separate peace treaty or armistice without the other's consent. And of course, they're fighting together. Why would they do that? But when things started to go bad, Premier Paul Reynaud of France asked Churchill to grant his permission to seek an armistice. And Churchill at first turned him down. But then a day or two later, he gave his consent, but it was very conditional. He said, you can query Hitler for his armistice terms as long as the French fleet sails for British ports. Churchill's big fear was that the French Navy, which was the fourth largest Navy in the world, would be turned on Britain and either help lead an invasion or choke the British or, you know, choke the UK from the water.
You see, this is the thing, isn't it? Because at this point, at the point that, you know, obviously this is early days. The States hasn't come into the war yet. And as you said, because the Kriegsmarine they have just got massive, you know, four or five massive pocket battleships, you decide, and there's another story to get involved with, but they don't have the amount of ships they need, that they would need to blockade or do serious damage to the Royal Navy or anything coming over from the States. However, the French fleet, France are a maritime power. That fleet can be seized by the Germans. It can be turned on the Royal Navy, and that would really throw the proverbial in the works for the UK in the war.
Absolutely. And not only that, about a month before Germany invaded France and the Low Countries, they invaded Denmark, and there were some furious sea battles there. And the German fleet, the Kriegsmarine, which was already at a disadvantage, was almost decimated there. Their U-boats were not affected, but almost half of their destroyers were sunk off the coast of Denmark. So they were in especially dire straits, and it seemed, you know, very obvious that they would be very interested in adding the French ships to their fleet at that point.
So where is the French fleet sitting at this point? Is it sort of off the coast of Normandy? Is it in Brest? Is it, you know, sailing down off the Côte d'Azur? I mean, tell me where exactly we could find the French fleet, Bill.
Great question. It was scattered, which added to the challenge. Some French ships were in British ports, because even up to a week before, spoiler alert, Britain attacked elements of the French fleet. Up to a week before that, more than half of the French fleet were in British ports. The most significant ships were in a port in Algeria, Marizal Kabir, which was an underdeveloped French fleet, a French port, excuse me. And there were two ships, the Richelieu and the Jean Bart. One was in Casablanca, one was in Dakar. And they were not completed. They were not, you know, their build out had not been finished, but they posed a threat to the British Isles. So part of Churchill's conundrum was, which ships do we go after? Because the Royal Navy assets were limited too.
And of course, Algeria at this point is a French colony, isn't it? That whole Moroccan coastline all the way through. It's it, apart from, you know, obviously the Italians have invaded Libya, but Algeria is French territory.
Yes, and geography was never one of my strong points, but in doing this research, I had to learn about geography, and there was that significant port in Algeria, Marizal Kabir, and that was where the heart of the battle took place. There was another significant port in Egypt, Alexandria, that was British controlled, but there were French ships anchored in Algeria. So there was another potential clash about to take place in Algeria as well. So there were conflicting levels of tension, and the actions in one port helped affect the tensions and the actions in the other port. So there was a lot going on in early July 1940.
And who's the main man then in terms of, because we've got a port, but obviously there's a town attached to it. So is there a governor general? Is there an admiral? Who is our French central character? Because people may have heard about Winston Churchill. He's been around a bit, but we've got no idea. You know, we have no idea. If you think sort of French generals, you're thinking Pétain, and you might be thinking de Gaulle, and that's probably as far as you get. So who have we got as the central French character, Bill?
Probably, you're definitely right about those two characters. There are two significant French admirals, Admiral François Dollon, who was the head of the French Navy. Someone called him an admiralissimo. He was in charge of the Navy. He had a group of admirals that were called the ADD, the Ami de Dollon. They were extremely loyal to him. And Dollon was Churchill's foil in terms of obviously different levels of rank in their government, but in the military. But Churchill wanted to be sure that Darlan would not allow his fleet to be turned over to the Germans. And Darlan swore that would never happen. Early in the war, he threatened to take the fleet himself to the U.S. or to Britain, but that relationship soured over time.
Now Churchill's going to know about this, because if you know anything about Churchill, you know he's been the first Lord of the Admiralty. You know, he is he's a naval man, so he understands the damage that this can inflict.
Yes, this was actually his second term as First Lord of the Admiralty until the day he became Prime Minister, because he had also been First Lord for a large part of the First World War. So, and some of his admirals said he'd never really gave that responsibility up through the war. He hesitated to overrule his generals, but he was more inclined to overrule his admirals and his first sea lord. So he was very involved in naval planning and naval tactics.
Now you may or may not be aware of this, you know, this sort of small things that have come between the English and the French down through history. We're thinking the Agincourt, Waterloo, small. So we have a special relationship with the French, I think we can say that. However, when it comes, you know, and indeed, I mean, if you look at sort of Nelson against Napoleon, I mean, forget the Iron Duke. I mean, Britain is the Royal Navy is British. A global power, all of that whole situation. And we're known as the whale, and the French are the elephant because of their armies. However, in the run-up to war, the French and British navies, Quel Horreur, have been actually working quite closely and training together, and officers know each other, literally on a first-name basis.
They knew each other. They were quartered on each other's ships. And the pride of the Royal Navy was HMS Hood. And for a long period of time, there was a French liaison officer on the Hood with the signals team. There were British officers on the French battleship Dunkirk, which is going to be one of the French ships that gets sunk during the clash.
The Hood. Now, I know we could go down a whole new thing with that, but The Hood is this battleship, which by this time it's commissioned, I think, end of the First World War. It's a throwback, yes. But it's also, it goes around the world, the empire, as if you like the Royal Yacht Britannia used to do. It's a statement of imperial power. Everybody knows who The Hood is, don't they? Even small boys in school know who The Hood is.
They did, I think. Yeah, my understanding is you would just have to show people the silhouette of The Hood, this crude drawing, and they would recognize The Hood. And service aboard The Hood was considered a distinct honor.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be the British flagship. It was a British admiral, James Somerville, and The Hood was his flagship during this clash.
So you've got the French admiral saying, I don't want this to fall into German hands. I will sail it to the US if necessary. And let's forget, Dennis has only got a couple of dozen U-boats at this point. It's not like you see in the movies where there are thousands lurking off San Navarre. So what happens that we get to this situation, Bill? I mean, how does this tragedy? I mean, it's a tragedy. How does it happen?
Well, over time, Darwin's responsibilities changed. He was admiral of the fleet, but then when France signed its armistice and Paul Reynaud resigned and Marshal Pétain became the premier of France, Darwin was brought into the government. So now he had some official responsibilities. And also, he started questioning the ability of Britain to hold out against Germany. He was very vocal within France in saying that he expected Britain to be overrun within a matter of weeks, either strangled from the sea or bombed out of existence. And he felt that if he sailed the ships to Britain, he would lose them to Germany, first to Churchill, and then to Germany anyway. So what was the point in that? And he also expressed at some point that he expected even worse treatment from Churchill than he was going to get from Germany. So his mindset changed completely. So he refused to turn his ships over, but he also assured Churchill and his other admirals, assured their counterparts in the Royal Navy, that if they were threatened by Germany, they would scuttle their ships. Regardless of what their expected outcome was for Britain, they still would not allow Germany to take their ships, and they would ensure that they would go to the bottom of the sea before they became part of the Kriegsmarine.
So when does Churchill, or when do the Allies or the British start to get worried, and when does, you know, the unthinkable Operation Catapult, when does it start to form? You know, when do they start to think, you know, listen chaps, we've got this problem here?
It formed very quickly. It started to, the plan started to come together in late June of 1940. And the First Lord of the Admiralty and the men who reported to him, they were adamant that they had to take quick action, and they developed this plan called Operation Catapult to take control of the French ships. Part of another thing that makes this story so fascinating is the officers, the next level and levels down, were horrified at the thought of taking action against their friends. They fought it. They initially pulled together a plan that would involve a fake attack. They were going to shoot over the French ships. They were going to drop bombs in the harbor that were aimed to miss the French ships. They thought they could threaten them and cajole them into complying with the British demands. But they also had that mortal threat at the end if necessary.
And so does a sort of fleet, does a task force set sail from, you know, is it somewhere out in the mid-Atlantic as they tend to be, and then sort of steam through Gibraltar, not a million miles from where I'm sitting, by the way, 30 minutes down the road from where I am at the moment.
Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly. We are close. Does it sort of steam through Gib and then just sit outside, and the French wake up one morning and go, zut alors?
It started in Gibraltar. So the fleet, it was called Force H, and they assembled in less than a week. It started with the Hood. There was also one of seven British aircraft carriers at the time, the Ark Royal. That was a very important part of the fleet. And there were 17 ships in total. And initially, the officers, Somerville and his officers, wanted to give the French a heads up that they were coming and give them an opportunity to submit. And Churchill was adamantly against that. He wanted there to be the element of surprise. So another element of this was there was another British officer, Cedric Holland, Captain Cedric Holland, who was very fluent in French. He had served in France before the war as the British naval attaché. He had the best contacts in the French Navy. And one other French admiral I have to add to the story is Admiral Marcel Bruno. Go ahead.
I'm just thinking, does Holland end up on the Hood in the end? Is Holland commanding officer of the Hood, or was that later on? Or I've got my Holland's cap. Yeah. Okay, anyway, that was that.
He was commander of the Ark Royal.
Right, thank you.
Yes. Out of the Hood.
And the other thing is that the important thing of this is aircraft carriers, and we're talking about one of the great unsung hero airplanes of the Second World War, which nobody knows about, the string bags, which are the swordfish, who will come into. Just brilliant planes.
They're incredible, and they played a key role. They were spotter planes the day of the clash. They. 3 days later, there was one French ship that had not yet been sunk. They came in flying low, launched torpedoes, and that sank that ship. But so Holland was fluent in French. He had the best contacts in the French fleet. He also had experience sailing under a French admiral, under that Admiral Marcel Bruno Jansoul,
right,
who was in control of the French ships at Mirz al Kabir. So the British. It seemed natural that Jansoul would be the very best person to negotiate with Jansoul because he was so fluent in French. He had a previous relationship. It was a friendly relationship. Jansoul, however, was immediately offended that the British sent a mere captain to negotiate with him.
I mean,
he was very proud, very stubborn. So that got things off to a poor start early in the morning of the negotiations.
And also the other thing is, I mean, you can't really negotiate with Vichy France because Pétain is 3,500 years old and doddering around the place. I mean, he's a general. He's army through and through. And they are in flux between, because it's Vichy France, which is basically south of the Loire, if you like, and then all points. Okay. So they're moving around the place, aren't they? They're in Bordeaux, and then they're in Lyon. And then there's not like headquarters of Vichy because they're moving around so much in these early months. Sorry,
that was an issue too. It was hard to find someone for approval that day. And Darlan, well, let me just say the Force H, the Hood, the Ark Royal, the other British ships, they were off the coast of Mirz al Kabir by 9 o'clock in the morning. Holland actually got there at 6 o'clock in the morning. Darlan did not find out about the British presence until 1 o'clock in the afternoon because of all of the moves of the French military.
Yeah.
And also the Germans had pretty much crippled their communications capabilities. So the communications were horrible. And at one point, Darlan had an order sent to Jansoul at Mirz al Kabir that every French ship was supposed to come to his aid and attack the British off the coast as they were sitting off the coast of Mirz al Kabir. The message was sent unencrypted. It was intercepted by the British. So they knew about this impending threat by about 1 o'clock, 1:30 in the afternoon. Jansoul did not receive that message until about 5:15 in the afternoon. Just as negotiations were about to end. So they were operating with limited information.
Is the French sort of, because the French fleet or the French, in port, they must be scenes of, absolute chaos when they suddenly wake up and they see, the Hood or, on the horizon, because they know this is, they can do serious damage here.
I thought so at first, but Holland arrived early in the morning. And he flashed a message that he was there to, to talk to the distinguished Admiral Jansoul. And the typical impression of the French seamen that I read was they were ecstatic because they thought the armistice had broken because they were limited in terms of their information. They're stuck on ships with not a lot of communication, and that the British were coming to ask them to rejoin the battle with them, specifically against Italy in the Mediterranean. Because as much as they disliked the German Navy, they really disliked the Italian Navy. So they were anxious. And on one ship, they considered inviting Holland to join them for lunch that day, where he's there to negotiate their surrender. So
wow,
there's some interesting communications.
So that some of them think, okay, you know, the roast beefs are here, the British are here, we're going to join up with them, and then we're going to go and stuff it to the Italians. Happy days.
Yes, yes. Wow. And then things, you know, it gradually worked its way through the French fleet that you know, Holland was actually there to negotiate their surrender. And the British put Jean Soule in a difficult position because they're basically asking him to, or demanding that he ignore the orders from Darlan, the definite head of the French Navy, and also ignore the armistice that they had just signed with their conqueror. So that would be a tough position for anybody to be put in. And he was naturally stubborn, so he refused to negotiate, and he never gave in, to his detriment, to the fatal results for his men.
Because here's the thing, Bill. If I'm commander of a company of combined services, if I've got 600 infantry, I mean, perish the thought, but you know what I mean, if I'm a major or whatever, or and I've got those 600 men, they're my concern. If I make a decision like, okay, we're going to fight on, I know that, you know, casualties of war, maybe lose 20% of those, others go in the bag, half of them get out alive. If you're the captain of a ship, right, and you engage with the force, As spoiler alert, Hood will come to find out in a couple of months down the line, one unlucky shell hits your ammunition, everybody's gone, literally vaporized within a second, 800 men gone on the Hood or even more. So that decision to say, I stand because I'm on a band, and this is a ship. You have been living with guys don't go, it's not like a platoon where you get reinforcements. With a ship, you are with these guys for 2 years at a time. So you know everybody personally. It's not like an infantry battalion, people come in and get replaced. So whilst you can sort of maybe sort of applaud, you know, I stand by the decision to fight for France or not wear my ships. At the same time, there's that human element. I don't think that people would consider, which is going to be a huge element for him to make. And also the guys, you know, sailors attacking sailors always have that, if you like, esprit de corps, even if it's an opposition, because you know what it's like being a sailor.
They do. They were horrified at the run up to this. They were mortified at the action they had to take. And I also found some interesting stories about the personal anguish in the aftermath. None of the British considered this a great military victory. I mean, they sunk, decimated one ship. They crippled several other ships. They killed over 1,200 of their former comrades. And, it was not a great military victory. It just felt wrong. And they also realized that they had turned France, and especially the French Navy, against Britain for the course of the war, in some cases forever. However, at the same point, Charles de Gaulle and others, even in the French Navy, realized, well, in order for France to rise again, we need Britain to succeed. So I have a hard time imagining how I would deal with emotions like that.
I mean, obviously, we want people to read the book, but I mean, it is, as always with naval warfare, these are huge. This is the end of, like, if you like, the battleship. So there are. It is not air power is used in perhaps spotting and then destroying a couple of ships, or whatever. But the main damage is done by massive battleships with massive guns, i.e., Hood on the Britannia, for example. Because everything from this point onwards will sort of turn into an aircraft, especially in the Americas and the Pacific, will turn into an aircraft carrier war. But this is one of the last actions where you see sort of big battleships doing what big battleships are supposed to do.
Yes, and then in the aftermath, less than a year later, was the Bismarck against the Hood.
Yeah.
And it was one of the biggest disasters in French naval history, when in a 17-minute battle, all of a sudden, the Hood just disappeared, was blown up, and only three survivors were rescued.
Oh, the Hood, yeah. I mean, that's a Bismarck shell that comes. I'll get you started. Get me started on Arcs of Fire, and then we'll be here a week, Bill. Okay,
perfectly able, perfectly lucky.
So, what's? I mean, again, we can go into further detail when people read the book. So what is the fallout then for Churchill, the Royal Navy and general world opinion? Is this seen as a necessary evil, if you like? And, you know, they should have surrendered, so he had no other option.
It was, and that was a big learning for me, because I went into this thinking that, well, I had a natural villain in Admiral Darlan to write about, and that was it's a blessing to a writer. And the more I dug into the story, to some degrees, he was not as much of a villain early in the war, but then later he became even more of a villain when he collaborated with the Germans. Churchill was content with the military results. He felt the Navy achieved what they had to do, but much more important than that was the message that his action sent to Franklin Roosevelt, for one, because we're still about 17 months from Pearl Harbor happening in the U.S. and America finally joining the war. And Roosevelt didn't need a lot of convincing, but that reinforced his belief that Churchill had the will and Britain had the might to continue the war. He also convinced Hitler that Churchill was unlike any other leader he had confronted to that point in time. And that was a major impression. He also convinced Mussolini that Britain was much more serious about the willingness to take mortal action, even against an ally, than anyone would have believed.
It's interesting because at some point, when Berlin's being bombed, and Goebbels will say total war. This is a total war, but this is just showing no quarter the whole situation against against one of your allies. I mean, it's a statement of intent that really can't be matched, can it?
No, it really couldn't. And I mentioned Roosevelt did not need convincing. The American Congress did need convincing because they were adamant that the United States had no role in another foreign war in which at that point it seemed like we had no direct stake. But the head of the Foreign Relations Committee in Congress did a complete 180, where a week before he was trying to convince Churchill to abandon the British Isles. He felt there was nothing you could do to forestall the German attack. And the day after the attack, he said, "This convinces me that Churchill would do what I never thought he would do."
Where do you get the information from? Because again, I mean, I have been in my previous life an English schoolboy, and so we know all about we are taught this at prep school. But we're not taught this. That you mention Algeria and the French discussion of the fleet, and in fact the whole. I mean, this is way before Operation Torch and whatever. But people look more blankly at me than they normally do. So how do you, Bill, find the information about this?
A lot of reading, obviously, from books from that point in the period of time. But also, the best part of this was digging into archives. I was very lucky. I'm not a natural historian. I was a software salesman when I started doing this, but I was so intrigued with the story. And I visited the Churchill Archives at the University of Cambridge, spent three amazing days there digging in, not so much the papers of Churchill, but Admiral James Somerville, Admiral Andrew Cunningham, and finding little pieces and bits of interesting information that I think added a lot to the story. So I had the outline of the story, but I think that what I found in the archives, there's also an American historian, Arthur Martyr, that has file after file of letters from the captains and admirals. So it was just priceless information.
Oh, that must be so. When you get your hands on that, that is literally, because I always say this about history, and this is the listeners are going to be rolling their eyes and throwing their wallets out the window. But because you lift that veil, and history is a living, it's not dead kings and dusty bookstores, people. It is a living, breathing thing, and we are literally the blink of an eye from these actions that happened some 80 something years ago.
Yes, and it's the human element. It's not that the HMS Hood fired 15-inch shells and 2,000-pound shells at the French ships. It's the anguish of Cedric Holland.
Yeah,
it's the fact that he was in tears when he saluted his French counterpart at Mers El Kabir just as negotiations broke off. So that's what makes history so compelling.
Bill, you've got to write the script. This has got to be, I'm just seeing the movie in my head. I mean, this knocks Master and Commander into a cocked hat, sir.
If you will produce it, I will write the script.
What could possibly go wrong? The book is... Bill, we're going to run out of time. Every time I talk to you, we are here for days. The book is called Operation Catapult. Listeners, go to the TRE Virtual Bookstore, click on the front page, and it'll be winging its way to you. Bill, if people want to find you online, I know that you've got a website, so this is your 5 seconds of promotion.
Thank you. Yeah, my personal website is perfectlytruestory.com. One word, perfectlytruestory.com. And there's information about the book, a lot of information about the research. The book is available most places except the UK right now. It'll just be released on
just
April
click
30th
on
in
it.
The
yeah,
UK.
If you click on the web page on a web page, it'll come wishing its way to you by some cunning yes. European route. You see, Bill. The book yes. is called Operation Catapult: Winston Churchill, the British Attack on the French Navy at Mez El Kebir. It is by the brilliant Bill Whiteside. Bill, thank you so much for your time today.
Giles, thank you. I thoroughly enjoyed this. This time flew by. I appreciate it.